from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So, Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders came up big in Wisconsin, and they want you to know it's a new day. Ted Cruz, after beating Donald Trump.
Tonight is a turning point. It is a rallying cry. It is a call from the hardworking men and women of Wisconsin to the people of America. We have a choice. A real choice.
A real choice in Bernie Sanders after whopping Hillary Clinton.
We have a path toward victory, a path toward the White House.
Deep now in the primary season, they're all still in it to win it. But how? This hour on Point, the word from Wisconsin and the tricky road ahead. We have a terrific panel with us today from Washington. Lisa Lehrer joins us, national political correspondent for the Associated Press. She's been following the Democrats. Welcome back, Lisa. Great to have you today.
Thanks for having me.
Also in Washington, Eliana Johnson, Washington editor at the National Review. Eliana, it's always great to have you with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And joining us by Skype from Austin, Texas, is Erica Greeter, senior editor at Texas Monthly and longtime Ted Cruz watcher. Erica, hello. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
So, Lisa, let's start with the Democrats. Do we have a new day here? Do we have a bump in the road, a big Sanders parade in the road? How do you interpret what we've just seen in Wisconsin?
Well, certainly it's a big win for Bernie Sanders. It's his sixth consecutive win in these Democratic primaries, but it's not doing all that much to shift the calculus in the Democratic race. Hillary Clinton still has a sizable lead, both in the pledged delegates and in those pesky superdelegates, the Democratic's and insiders who can choose either candidate to support for the nomination. And that's going to be really hard for him to overcome, basically because these primaries are proportional. So even if Hillary Clinton loses, she still gains delegates or a share of the pie. So it becomes really hard for him to make enough inroads to overcome her lead, which now is about 250 delegates and pledged delegates. It's even greater when you count the superdelegates. So basically, going out from here on, he has to win and win really big. Our calculation at the AP shows that he has to win by 68% to actually capture the nomination. And
all
that's
of the
be
rest of the voting,
hard.
You mean in the everything yes. between now and the convention, 68%.
Exactly. And that's a really high bar. I mean, I don't think he's won a few Western caucus states by those kinds of margins, but there aren't really any caucus states yet left after Wyoming, which is voting Saturday. And Sanders has tended not to do quite as well in primary states, particularly closed primaries where only registered Democrats participate. So this is a pretty high bar for him, and it's certainly not going to be easy.
There was none of that feeling last night in his comments. He was in Laramie, Wyoming here talking after the Wisconsin primary, saying he's on a streak, he's going to stay there. And a little secret about Hillary Clinton, he said.
Please keep this a secret. Do not tell Secretary Clinton. She's getting a little nervous, and I don't want her to get more nervous. But I believe we've got an excellent chance to win New York and a lot of delegates in that state.
All right, Lisa, one more second just on this. 68% of everything else, and good luck to him if he can do it. If he can't, the superdelegate strategy is there. Is that real, that he could persuade enough to come over to him if he's got enough momentum going, saying, look, I'm the one to take on the Republican candidate? We had Tad Devine with us a couple weeks ago, the first time that they rolled that out publicly, that strategy, as far as I know. Is that a real option for the Sanders campaign? Come on, superdelegates, join me, change.
Well, it's certainly not going to be easy. By our count over at AP, there are about 200 undecided superdelegates, and a fair share of those people are folks who don't want to be out public for one candidate or the other. There's about 700 overall. So he has to win over a fair number of these folks. He has to flip people who have already come behind Hillary Clinton. I think that's not going to be hard. That's going to be hard, rather. That's something that President Barack Obama was able to do when he was running against Hillary Clinton in 2008. But, you know, superdelegates are, by their nature, Democratic insiders. That's sort of the definition of a superdelegate. He's been running this very outside campaign. He doesn't really have the same ties to the party. He was an independent for the vast majority of his congressional career, really just mm-hmm. up until he ran for president. So I think it's going to be hard for him to make the case to these sort of Democratic insiders that they should back his candidacy. He's pointing to polls that show him running stronger in the general election than Hillary Clinton against Donald Trump. So he's trying to make an electability argument to these superdelegates. But as far as we know from our reporting, there hasn't been any sort of massive outreach to these folks by the Sanders campaign quite yet. We may see that as this race continues.
We'll come back to Bernie Sanders. Let's go to Ted Cruz. Here he was last night in Milwaukee celebrating that Wisconsin win, big win for him. Momentum, he said, on his side. He's going to have the delegates.
As a result of tonight, as a result of the people of Wisconsin defying the media, defying the pundits, I am more and more convinced that our campaign is going to earn the 1,237 delegates needed to win the Republican nomination.
Or maybe not, he was quick to indicate. Here's saying, you know, either before Cleveland or somehow at the convention itself, maybe hinting at that contested convention scenario. Cruz again.
Either before Cleveland or at the convention in Cleveland, together we will win a majority of the delegates, and together we will beat Hillary Clinton in November.
Ted Cruz celebrating in Wisconsin last night. Eliana Johnson is with us from the National Review. Let us remember, they put against Trump right on their cover not so long ago. But you're out reporting on this, Eliana. What do you see in the Cruz victory? What's the source of this victory in Wisconsin before we look ahead?
Well, I think the takeaway here is that what Trump's critics have been saying for a long time is that what's needed to defeat him is really an all-hands-on-deck effort that involves elected officials. Like in Wisconsin, you saw Scott Walker come out, Republican donors funding super PACs that would put ads on the air, and the media, like conservative talk radio hosts who in many cases have given Trump cover or supported him. Well, in Wisconsin, you really saw all these forces working in tandem against Donald Trump. And as a result, you saw voters who have been divided in previous contests between Trump's opponents really consolidate behind Ted Cruz. They were not divided between Cruz and John Kasich. And so I think Wisconsin is going to be viewed as a case study in how really an all-hands-on-deck effort can defeat Donald Trump and will really rally the opposition forces going forward to take this to a convention. I do think that's the only way Trump will be defeated. Cruz would now have to win about 80% of the remaining delegates, which seems unlikely. But I do think it will be viewed as a case study and proof that Trump can be defeated if voters consolidate behind an alternative.
Eliana, when you say all hands on deck, it suggests a kind of active coordination. Is this it? Is this the revenge of the party mainstream collecting all its resources and deploying them against Donald Trump? Did they actively do that in Wisconsin, or was it an organic coming together of opposition?
You know, they didn't, but I would say the stars aligned for the anti-Trump movement, where Governor Scott Walker came out and endorsed Ted Cruz. And he didn't just lend his endorsement passively. He sat and filmed ads for Cruz. He appeared at events with him, and he was really a vociferous spokesman for Cruz. And super PACs had powerful ads on the air. The Club for Growth, for example, aired spent seven figures in Wisconsin saying that a vote for Kasich is a vote for Trump. And that really hurt Kasich, who really underperformed in the so-called wow counties, the suburban counties where he was expected to perform far more strongly than he did. And so I think you really saw the anti-Trump, it's been called a movement, but it's really not a movement. It's been uncoordinated, independent efforts, but all operating in tandem in a way that they really haven't been before in Wisconsin. And I think you will see that more and more going forward, because Wisconsin was proof that if all conservative forces who are working against Trump do their part, he cannot get above a 30-35% ceiling. And I would point out that in other contests, in other states, elected officials or talk radio haven't played the role that they have in Wisconsin.
Stars align, but that suggests something a little passive, and maybe stars align in a different way in different states. Trump has the Northeast coming. Maybe he's got a better chance there. I want to look further at that convention scenario. But coming out of this, maybe to the surprise of many, if you would have asked them just months ago, and certainly, I don't know, a year plus ago, Ted Cruz, Erica Greeter, here's Ted Cruz out of your state, Texas, in Washington, one of the most divisive politicians in living memory. And now he's putting himself forward as the unifier in opposition to Donald Trump. With your experience watching him come up out of Texas, do you see him able to hold that position? He's been so gritty and divisive in Washington. Can he hold that role as uniter, Erica?
Well, I'm not sure he can win over the hearts and minds in Washington itself, where he has been consistently unpopular since being sworn to the Senate just 3 years ago.
Yep.
But as far as campaigning among conservatives in the remaining states, I think he definitely can. You know, one thing we've seen throughout this primary is that he has a pattern of doing well in the caucus states, the more participatory states, and in the states where he's known, right? So Texas, he won by 17 points in a five-way field. Iowa, he was trailing going into the caucus and came out as the winner. He won caucuses in Utah, Kansas, Maine, Alaska. It seems like whenever he has a chance to get below the sort of, to sort of escape the cable news saturation coverage of Trump and to be heard by people, that he does well. And actually, in a way, you can look at Governor Scott Walker's endorsement in Wisconsin.
Oh, losing Erica for a second there. Lisa Lehrer, I don't know if you're watching over the fence there at Ted Cruz and how he's put this together, but it is remarkable to hear the words, "I'm the unifier," coming out of the mouth of this guy who was so divisive in the nation's capital.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a remarkable, remarkable thing. And there really are Republicans of two minds here in Washington. There's, a club who says, we have to do anything we can to stop Donald Trump, so that means unifying behind Ted Cruz, a guy that many of them really, frankly, just don't like. There's another group who says, well, you know, Donald Trump might be someone that will cut deals. He's a businessman. He might be someone that Republicans in Washington can work with. So I think there is a bit of division here in Washington, but certainly
what
it's a surprising
is on the
turn of events.
Right now. Lisa Lehrer, please stand by there at AP. Eliana Johnson at National Review. Erica Greeter will be right back to you. Listeners, we're looking at the big Wisconsin results. You can join us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz, their big wins in Wisconsin, and the way ahead for the GOP and the Democrats. Lisa Lehrer is with us from AP, national political reporter there. Eliana Johnson, Washington editor for the National Review. Erica Greeter of Texas Monthly is with us from Austin, Texas. Last night, Bernie Sanders talked to supporters at a campaign rally in Laramie, Wyoming, about the path forward.
I think the people of this country are tired of establishment politics and establishment economics. I think the people of this country are ready for a political revolution. And if you ignore what you hear on corporate media, the facts are pretty clear. We have a path toward victory, a path toward the White House.
And Bernie Sanders saying he's on the path, on the path. He's got a path. Donald Trump, nothing to say last night. Unusual for him on a primary voting night. But, of course, he lost. Just a written statement out talking about Lion Ted Cruz. And as you were saying, Eliana, sort of complaining that everybody ganged up on Donald. The Trump statement saying Ted Cruz is worse than a puppet. He's a Trojan horse. He's being used by the party bosses attempting to steal the nomination from Mr. Trump, from the Trump campaign statement there. In Milwaukee, Cruz had his own take on what had just happened.
We are winning because we're uniting the Republican Party. Of the 17 candidates who started this race, a terrific, talented, dynamic field, five have now endorsed this campaign. When you toss in Senator Mike Lee and Mark Levin, we've got the full spectrum of the Republican Party coming together and uniting behind this campaign.
Ted Cruz, the divider in Washington, talking full spectrum unification last night in Wisconsin. Let's go to our callers. Hartford, Connecticut. Cody's calling. Hi, Cody. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Yeah.
My question is ultimately, with Donald Trump losing, you know, last night in Wisconsin, it seems apparent that his path to the convention is going to be bumpy. The convention we're looking at in terms of the 2012 rules and the Mitt Romney convention, how realistic is that the convention rules will be adjusted to affect the ability of Donald Trump to actually obtain the nomination of the Republican Party in Cleveland.
Cody, let us pick it right up. Eliana, you're looking at all of this. Now, of course, if somebody doesn't win on the first round of voting, then delegates are free to move and groove and take their vote where they like. What about other adjustments that might be made to advantage Ted Cruz here? If it's all hands on deck, and your magazine is certainly for that, what are the potential levers that might be pulled here?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the rules of each convention are actually written just days before the convention is called into session. And so there is, of course, the potential that the RNC, the Republican National Committee, if its members so chose, could rewrite the rules to disadvantage Donald Trump. I think it's highly unlikely they will do so, in part because if this contest goes to a convention, that in itself will disadvantage Trump and advantage a candidate like a Ted Cruz or a John Kasich. And I think it's a comparable situation to what Lisa Lair said about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and the superdelegates. Delegates to a Republican convention are Republican insiders who are simply not inclined to be Donald Trump supporters. And the irony in this is that Ted Cruz, who has campaigned as an outsider, may in fact be the choice of these Republican insiders over a Donald Trump in the way that Hillary Clinton, even if these superdelegates are lobbied by Bernie Sanders, will simply be the choice of superdelegates on the Democratic side. So I don't think the rules will be rewritten on purpose in a way to disadvantage Donald Trump, but I don't think they need to be rewritten because the convention in itself, by the nature of the delegates and attendees, I think disfavors him by its very nature.
Erica Greeter in Austin, Texas, you've looked deeply at Ted Cruz. We've heard a lot about him prepping very carefully now for that battle that would come if it's a contested convention, having delegates lined up who would come to him if it's not settled on the first ballot. Does that line up with the Ted Cruz way of doing politics out of Texas?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, keep in mind, Ted Cruz had a staffer in Guam in August. I mean, well before anybody anticipated that this scenario would come to pass, right?
In other words, fighting for every last delegate. They don't have many out of Guam.
Right, and he's passed. I mean, he's mapped out every strategy, I'm sure, for both the primary and the general election, including this one he's looking at now. And so now that the delegates are starting to be named, I would guess that in Ted Cruz HQ in Houston, there's probably a room with like a wall with everyone's name and like a photo and like an index card saying where their kids go to college and so on. But I mean, you know, there's going to be very, very strong individuated outreach to every delegate just to make the case to them directly that he's a better choice for the party to nominate than Donald Trump, which is frankly not a hard case to make to conservatives and Republicans who've been with the party for a long time.
But Eliana, I'm trying to get my head around Donald Trump. If he's if and we've got a lot of big votes to come here, and he may well come back and Ted Cruz could be in his shadow again. I mean, he's still behind in the delegates. Let's remember. But if Donald Trump is put on his back foot, a little self-immolation going on the last couple of weeks, but if he's in trouble and he can't take it, doesn't have the delegates to sweep in and just have it, and it gets into this kind of battle, I mean, you see how he uses the power of rhetoric and showmanship and provocative ideas to really get people going. Can you imagine the disarray that he could bring into this setting before this is all over, Eliana?
I can absolutely imagine that. I expect that there will be protests and disarray. I don't expect that to intimidate, essentially, the delegates at this convention who are longtime Republicans familiar with the rules and the processes that govern the convention and will be actually writing the rules before the convention goes in session.
Yeah, but a lot of them will be Trump supporters in that hall, and not to mention all the pressure out across the country.
I think there will be plenty of Trump supporters in the hall, but the people who are elected as delegates because of Cruz, in part because of Cruz's superior ground game. North Dakota is a great example where there is no caucus or primary in the state, and delegates are merely elected. And Cruz managed to get supporters in 18 of the 25 of those delegate positions. I think the delegates themselves are far more likely to favor traditional Republican candidate like a Cruz or a John Kasich, I think, even has more of a chance to be nominated in a convention, a contested convention setting, than a Donald Trump, who has a very little ground organization and is a candidate essentially coming from outside either of the two parties.
This could be wild.
Tom,
Kasich with
the
zero delegates yesterday in Wisconsin. Sorry. Yes, please.
Oh, Tom, hi, it's Lisa. Mm-hmm. I think it is worth noting on a larger point mm-hmm. that Republicans really have no good options at this convention. Either they end up with Donald Trump or Ted Cruz, both of whom will face a pretty uphill battle in winning a general election. There's been a number of studies showing surveys showing how high Donald Trump's unfavorability rating is with the kinds of groups that tend to decide our general elections, like women voters. And Ted Cruz, of course, has taken a number of positions, very, very conservative positions that are out of step with where the general electorate is. So that's one choice, a really steep uphill climb to win the White House. The other option they face is trying to insert someone new into the process, which will be hard for all the reasons already outlined.
You're talking
and
about an entirely new, like a dark horse, a Paul Ryan or something.
A dark horse. There's some chatter about
kind
that.
Kind of unimaginable after all of this work. Oh, my gosh.
Exactly. And if they end up doing that, they overturn the will of a lot of their own voters, particularly their grassroots. So I think the options that Republicans are looking at, the outcome, potential outcomes of this convention, it really seems like they don't have many good options in terms of winning the White House.
Let's go to New Orleans and Aaron. Aaron, thank you for calling from New Orleans. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I was just listening to, you know, a lot of the back and forth conjecture about, you know, Ted Cruz's chances of possibly somehow figuring out a way to overcome Trump's lead. And I was curious if we could talk a little bit about maybe a comparison of the distance between Trump and Cruz versus, you know, the distance between Clinton and Sanders. Seems like a lot of the talk with Sanders is, you know, oh, isn't it interesting he's winning? But then the conversation just kind of drops there. And I don't hear any, you know, similar excitement or conjecture about, well, really, could he, you know, overcome Clinton? You know, what are his chances? It seems like there's a difference in tone there.
We're all about looking at what exactly is going on right here. And we're happy to look at the different delegate counts and what's going to be required here. Aaron, I appreciate your call from New Orleans. Lisa, we're getting a lot of people calling in on your assertion that Bernie Sanders needs 68% of the remaining vote to win. Sanders people are saying 58%, Lisa, 58%.
So our number on that, the 68% counts the superdelegates. That's probably why there's some difference of opinion there. Now, you know, there's a lot of people even within the Democratic Party who don't think the superdelegates are a good force, that they should have a role determining the outcome of the primary. But this is the rules as they are written, and they do play a significant part in determining the outcome of the primary. So what we have, what our AP's count, is that Sanders needs to win 68% of the remaining delegates and uncommitted superdelegates if he wants to clinch the nomination. And that's going to be tough. And frankly, even wins of 58% of pledged delegates would be pretty hard. I mean, these are not states. These are big competitive states. It's hard. That would really be a blowout for him, and that's tough.
And what do you make of the relative gap between, let's say, at this point, Trump and Cruz? Trump's something like 740 delegates to Cruz's 514 coming out of Wisconsin. Bernie Sanders with 1,056 to Hillary Clinton's 1,743. That's delegates, not superdelegates. Are those comparable gaps? Are they equally difficult to surmount, Lisa? I don't know if you've really weighed them against one another.
Well, I think the difference is in the way the Democratic rules work. It's a proportional system. So state by state. So once someone has a lead, it's just hard to catch up because think about it, right? Hillary Clinton is always accumulating more delegates. She even picked up
quite a few in Wisconsin, even though she lost by such a thumping loss there.
Right. She lost by – it was a pretty significant loss. I think the outcome that we ended up with, according to the AP's calculation, is that Sanders won 47 delegates to Clinton's 36. Mm-hmm. And there's still the three that have to be allocated. So it's not like she came out of this with no delegates. So she's adding to her lead. It becomes difficult for him to catch up just because of the way the system works. That's not the same on the Republican side. So I think that's part of the difference here. I also think there is a difference in terms of policy, where the policy differences between Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders are just not as big as the differences between Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. Donald Trump has taken a number of positions that really aren't traditionally Republican positions. So the gulf there is much bigger in terms of policy.
We're looking at the results out of Wisconsin and how they set up the race ahead for the nominations in the two parties. Leon, Iowa, Marjorie's calling. Hi, Marjorie. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm calling in regards to the fact that I don't understand why so many people are voting for Cruz, because Cruz is going to stop all the Social Security, all Medicare, and he wants to stop Obamacare. He doesn't want any of it. So why are many people from Wisconsin and everywhere voting for Cruz?
Well, all right. Well, Eliana, how do you interpret it? I see out of Wisconsin that he showed strength beyond his base of hardline and religious conservative Republicans. Is this anti-Trump? Is it pro-Cruz in some dimension? You hear Marjorie out of Iowa saying, wait a minute, this guy's actually, in his own terms, fairly radical.
That's right. But he, the way I think, the best way to understand it is that Cruz, people are rallying behind Cruz because he is the strongest opponent against a candidate, Donald Trump, who is running on a platform essentially against reforming entitlements. And entitlement reform has been a key plank of the Republican platform for the past several decades. And so Cruz is more conservative than the mainstream Republican candidates have been traditionally, but they view him as the only person who's capable of defeating somebody whose many of whose positions are inimical to those of the Republican Party.
Erica, you know Ted Cruz again, well out of Texas. Remind us just how hard right Ted Cruz proudly is, and think with us about how those positions would hit a general election field.
Well, I would say that Ted Cruz is less hard right than he is perceived to be, although that can be a pretty low bar since he's perceived to be like the most right-wing radical person in the history of right-wing radicalism.
That's how he presents himself again and again, with fervor.
But so, sorry, I misunderstood what you said, but to the question from Marjorie about the entitlement, what he said about entitlement reform is that he wouldn't change anything for current beneficiaries, but that he'd like to pursue reforms that will take effect over time to, you know, fix the actuarial deficits we currently see in things like Social Security and repeal Obamacare as a separate plank of its platform. And it's kind of interesting. It points to, I think, a comparison between the two primaries that hasn't gotten a lot of attention and that I am not really expert in because I haven't been following the Democrats as closely. But there's a real generational disjunct between Cruz and Trump. Young voters favor Cruz, who is, of course, you know, pretty young at 45. And I think that you see a similar pattern with young voters favoring Sanders by big margins over Clinton.
Yep, yep. Why? You're saying they favor Cruz because what? Because he's not tied into the public programs that Donald Trump is still vowing to defend?
Well, on entitlement reform, for example, I mean, that's a perfect example. I'm younger than Cruz even, and I think about Social Security as something that would be quite easy to reform in a way that would protect benefits for current retirees, but would also make those benefits available for retirees in my generation. I mean, just thinking about raising the retirement age by a bit or grandfathering it in so it raises, you know, gradually over time. Think about ending the payroll tax cap. These are all fixes that are mathematically much easier to do now than 30 years from now when the shortfall will be in effect. So looking at it, you know, looking at the state of entitlements from like with a 50-year time horizon, 100-year time horizon, I think that as a young voter, I can understand why young Republicans would respond to somebody who's pitching that rather than Donald Trump saying no changes whatsoever.
Lisa Lehrer, you were saying that Ted Cruz would have trouble in a general election, but what about it? Erica's suggesting maybe he can morph out of his hyper-right reputation and look like the man of the future, the young view.
I mean, certainly that's not something that Democrats are going to really acquiesce to. I suspect we'll see a lot of ads painting Ted Cruz as from Democrats painting him as very right wing, particularly on things like abortion. He doesn't favor exceptions. So I think they will certainly be delving through his record to try to paint him as far to the right as possible, particularly on social issues.
Lisa Lehrer, please stand by. National political reporter for the Associated Press, Erica Greeter with Texas Monthly out of Austin, Texas today. Eliana Johnson with us from the National Review in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz, their big wins in Wisconsin and the way ahead. Both these winners celebrating last night. Ted Cruz saying, we're gaining on Trump.
In the last 2 weeks and in the coming days when Colorado and Wyoming finish voting, we are likely to have gained over 100 delegates on Donald Trump.
And Bernie Sanders defining momentum his way, leapfrogging in his remarks last night in Wyoming, right over Hillary Clinton, going after the Donald.
Momentum is that when you look at national polls or you look at statewide polls, we are defeating Donald Trump by very significant numbers.
Bernie Sanders, with a lot of cheering there for him and his claim of momentum. Andrew, in Nashville, Tennessee. Andrew, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. So I'm representing, I think, what is a sort of a unique demographic. I grew up in a very devout Republican household. I went to school, got a degree in political science, and became an independent as a result of
that.
And I see, like, in the millennial group as a whole, what we're looking at is a lot of people who are now identifying as independents in a larger percentage than I think most of American history than ever before.
So where are you going here, Andrew? Where does it take you?
Well, basically what this is a lot of these people we see as a demographic as supporting Bernie Sanders. And the main reason behind that is because not a lot of us are buying into this two-party system, this black and white ideal that we have to fit into this very distinct mold of these one or two parties. And I think Bernie Sanders rises above a lot of those standards that we see in this, and that allows us to identify with him as a whole more. We see his support in all of these states that he's winning, and he's winning this demographic group by significant and substantial amounts. And I think that as a trend of going forward in the future, that's what we're likely to see more and more with millennials voting for people who maybe not have the strongest Democratic background as a whole as part of the party, but maybe going into these political parties and running under them, knowing that running in the two-party system is the only way they can make a viable candidacy.
Andrew, I hear you. Erica Greeter, of course, Hillary Clinton making a negative out of that, saying, I'm the lifelong Democrat, making much that Bernie Sanders has not been. But what do you hear in that, in the millennial support, which has been so strong and so important for Bernie Sanders? And you hear it right there. Andrew articulates it. We want to get out of this sort of polarized two-party thing that just hasn't been working for the country. Does that look like enough of a wave for Bernie Sanders to ride? It's hard not to sympathize with people looking around and saying, this isn't working.
Well, yeah, certainly it's hard not to empathize with that with that view in this era of Trump. But and I think you see a substantial that feeling is pretty prevalent on the Republican side too, hence the support for Trump and Cruz, who are both outsiders in their own way. But I think as far as, are we going to see a realignment? Are we going to see either party or both parties crack up and sort of reshape themselves along slightly different lines? It's probably too soon to tell. Texas is a bit anomalous when it comes to this because Hillary Clinton is very, very strong among Texas Democrats. Bernie has pockets of support in places like Austin, where I live. But Hillary Clinton won the primary easily and with a lot of support from young voters. She's always been popular here. And I think that Lisa might have a sense of this better than I would, but I would guess that similar to 2008, when we did see the Democratic Party come back together after a long and pretty hotly contested primary between Clinton and Obama, we'll see Democrats coalesce around whoever their nominee is in the end.
Maybe. Yes, please, Lisa.
I think the thing that will help that more than anything else would be Donald Trump. I mean, a lot of Democrats are sort of banking that Donald Trump's divisiveness will bring their party back together. But that is one of the big questions going forward. Should Hillary Clinton capture this nomination, how does she win back these young voters who have turned out really in droves for Bernie Sanders? And is she able to energize and mobilize them in the same way? I'm not sure she will be. And certainly that's something that her campaign is very concerned with right now.
Caroline in Carrier, Mississippi. Maybe just lost Caroline. Let's go to Brandon, Plainfield, Connecticut. Brandon, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for having me. My question was, if, say, Hillary doesn't get the majority of the delegates, but the superdelegates give it to her, or something similar happens to Trump and Cruz, what's in the future for the party? Are they going to break apart? Are they... we're going to actually have a chance of having more than just Democrats, Republicans. We could maybe have a third or fourth party like most of the countries in the world.
Let me pick that up with each party. Let me start. I appreciate your call, Brandon. Let me start with you, Eliana. If it's really hammer and tongs, if it's really a fight, everybody's saying the GOP is kind of ruptured already. Do you see a path toward mending here? We'll look at the Democrats. Start with the GOP.
Yeah. Well, I think that the Republican Party is going to change as an ideological entity. Conservatism has been the ideology that has undergirded the Republican Party essentially since the Barry Goldwater's candidacy in 1964. And I think that's going to change a little bit with a widening Republican recognition as a result of Donald Trump's candidacy that the party has really failed downscale and lower middle class white voters who bolted the Democratic Party during the Nixon administration or Nixon's candidacy in the 70s and essentially have bolted the Republican Party now, and they are protesting both parties, as one of the previous callers said. But the Republican Party is going to do what I think is going to reform itself in an effort to capture those voters. I don't think that's going to happen necessarily because we go to a contested convention or that the two-party system is going to break up because of a contested convention. So I don't think a contested convention is going to cause a third-party run or that it would be the end of the two-party system at all. Nonetheless, I do think that the Republican Party has gotten a wake-up call in this election and that we'll see an GOP with a slightly different ideological coloring going forward.
Lisa Lehrer, what about the Democrats? I mean, you've seen Hillary Clinton has evolved toward Bernie. She's gone left to be closer to Sanders as he's picked up momentum. Nevertheless, these are not carbon copies of one another. Do you see a gap opening here that's going to require what kind of mending to get past?
Well, certainly the Democratic Party has moved to the left during President Obama's time in office, but I don't think the differences between Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders are quite as severe as what we see going on the Republican side. Part of what's happening here is a referendum on Hillary Clinton. She has pretty high unfavorability ratings herself, not as high as Donald Trump, of course, but, you know, a large number of Americans just don't like her, and she's coming into this having spent decades on the public stage. She's one of the best-known political figures in the country, if not the world. She has a lot of baggage. So part of what we're seeing is about that. The other part is sort of this general anti-establishment mood that's in the country. Democrats and Republicans are looking for people who are outside the political system. And even though Bernie Sanders has been in Congress for decades, he was an independent, so he has been able to fit that mold. But I think when you look at policies, the differences between Sanders and Secretary Clinton are there, but they're just not as wide as on the Republican side of the fence. You have Bernie Sanders talking about free college. You have Hillary Clinton talking about debt-free college. You have Bernie Sanders talking about breaking up the big banks by reinstating Glass-Steagall. You have Hillary Clinton talking about imposing new taxes on the big banks. So there are certainly differences, but there's a whole lot they agree on criminal justice and immigration and abortion. So I just think the policy splits are simply not as severe on the Democratic side as what we're seeing on the Republican side right now.
Let's go to Los Alamos, New Mexico. Douglas, you're on the air. Thanks for calling, Douglas.
Oh, hi, Tom. Very quick comment. I believe Bernie Sanders, should he be the nominee, is totally unelectable because the GOP will dog him with two words, communist and socialist. He really isn't, but much of this country believes that. Thank you.
I appreciate your call, Douglas. Erica Greeter, I don't know if you're listening. You can hear that already. There are plenty of Republican politicians when they turn to Bernie. Those are among the first dozen words out of their mouth, and almost just as Douglas put it there, is that a poison pill in American politics now, or has Bernie made the case? You know, say what you will, the current system's not working. We need something different.
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's, of course, too soon to tell. We've never seen somebody run for president, or not, you know, for generations, who's a self-described democratic socialist. I think thus far, in a way, the fact that Sanders has been publicly describing himself in those terms for so long, even though maybe in Vermont, but, you know, otherwise there's no possible political gain to be derived from saying that about yourself, conveys a certain amount of integrity and authenticity that Democrats find appealing, but Republicans also find somewhat appealing, right? So when I hear people talk about Sanders, you know, conservatives in Texas who are legion, like the states crawling for conservatives. They have this sort of bemused, kind of affectionate view of Sanders. And I'm not sure if that would harden if he was actually to become the nominee, or if there would be a sense of, well, okay, you know, we have a democratic socialist as president, but better than the sort of crypto pseudo-socialist we had in Obama. And he still has to deal with Paul Ryan as Speaker of the House and Congress, so be it. I think it's an interesting question, but I'm not sure I would say it's clearly a poison pill.
I don't know how crypto anything President Obama's been, but we'll look at the whole thing. We're looking at the results out of Wisconsin. Lisa, Bernie Sanders sat down with the New York Daily News, and his interview with the editorial board there is getting a pretty big airing in some quarters. They pressed him very hard on how he would actually enact some of his major fundamental policies. Breaking up the banks, they said, how would you do it? How would you do it? They really pressed him on it. And it's being presented in headlines here as a moment where Bernie Sanders was not ready to deliver. Have you gone through the transcript? Have you read it? Do you see a candidate who couldn't deliver on a fundamental premise?
I did read through that transcript. It was awfully in-depth and awfully long, which is what we want to see from our editorial boards, right?
Yeah.
And it did seem like a number of times he didn't have the kind of ease with specifics that you sometimes expect from candidates in these boards. I actually thought the more damaging moment, perhaps, was something that the New York Daily News splashed across their front page. You want a sign that we're in a New York primary. You have to embrace the tabloids, who are really going to give these candidates a rough ride. So they splashed across the front page that Bernie Sanders did not believe that gun makers who were involved in the Sandy Hook massacre at that elementary school in Connecticut should be held liable in lawsuits. That's a damaging thing in New York. Keep in mind that they share a media market with Connecticut. Mm-hmm. There was coverage of those horrific murders for a year and, you know, years actually after they happened.
Sure.
So this is something that people in New York felt that they lived through. Connecticut votes just a week later on April 26th. So I think that could be a damaging moment for him. It also played into this narrative that the Clinton's campaign has been pushing for months, which is that Bernie Sanders has been weak on gun control. That's an issue that's very motivating to the Democratic base. They want to see tighter restrictions on guns. Every town hall meeting you go to for Bernie Sanders or for Hillary Clinton, someone asks a question about gun control. So I thought that was actually even more damaging for him than his lack of specificity on his financial plans.
Hillary Clinton was ready to jump all over it. Here she was on NBC's Morning Joe. This is just today, answering a question of whether or not Bernie Sanders is ready to be president.
I think he hadn't done his homework, and he'd been talking for more than a year about doing things that he obviously hadn't really studied or understood. And that does raise a lot of questions. And really what it goes to is for voters to ask themselves, can he deliver what he's talking about? Can he really help people?
Hillary Clinton wants you to wonder, can he deliver? Adam in Syracuse, New York, upstate New York. Adam, thanks for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In response to that soundbite, I think that he already has pointed out that he's done his homework. The recent Panama scandal, which Bernie Sanders forewarned when the Panama trade deal was on the floor in Congress.
The Panama Papers, all the offshore money, yep.
Yep. And meanwhile, Secretary Clinton was for it. And I think the amount of foresight that Sanders has shown might serve to pull the clothes in New York even closer.
Adam, I appreciate your call. So here we are. What an interesting thing. This deep in the primaries, and still, it may be tough for, it may be a hard road for Bernie Sanders, but he's saying he's got it, and his supporters certainly want him to have it. Republicans, with potentially this all being provided in decided in Cleveland on the convention floor. I mean, it's just, I can't remember a season when we were this deep into it with that much fireworks still out in front of us. Eliana Johnson, what are you predicting at this point? Can you see Trump still getting back on his horse after Wisconsin, finding his feet in New York in the Northeast, and rolling right on into a position where, all hands on deck or not, Republicans do not have the firepower to his opponents in the party to push him back?
I do think Trump will find his footing in New York. He's very likely to win there. And going into the Northeast, so I think John Kasich will also perform in some states out there. But he's going to have to win over 50% of the remaining delegates going into the convention. And I think that's unlikely. So I think we're headed for a contested convention. And I think that's difficult territory for Trump.
Lisa Lehrer, if it's really down to the wire on the Democrat side, or how close can it be when they finally get into Philadelphia for their convention, for Bernie Sanders still to make a run at enough superdelegates and try and woo them over to pull it out?
I think the superdelegate argument will be hard. Listen, I think it's not impossible for Bernie Sanders, but this is a tough road for him ahead. He has a tough road ahead.
Tough road. A lot of passion. You hear him talking about the momentum right there. Hillary Clinton campaigning like crazy in her home state of New York, a kind of must-win now for her. And now, Ted Cruz, the man of the hour out of Wisconsin in the GOP. Who would have thought it? But there he stands. Erica Greeter with Texas Monthly with us from Austin, Texas today. Erica, come again. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Eliana Johnson, Washington editor for the National Review. Thank you for helping us poke in here and look around, Eliana. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And Lisa Lehrer, national political reporter for the Associated Press. Lisa, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.